Okay, good evening. What we are discussing tonight is what I am calling the reunification of Yerushalayim. In other words, 2 weeks ago we spoke about what makes Yerushalayim special. We also then had a share last week about the unification of Yerushalayim, what exactly happened at the times of David HaMelech. And tonight we're going to talk about the reunification of Yerushalayim. Now the reunification of Yerushalayim in some ways is easier to understand exactly what happened. There are tons of books about all the details of the war, etc. And what we will do tonight is in two parts. Part one is going to be just a brief review of what happened in the war. And part two will be to try to put it into some sort of religious perspective. Because we're supposed to be learning Torah. So it's not just about, although my son would very much appreciate if we'd only discuss military history, but the fact is that we're also supposed to try to put this into Torah perspective, and we'll try to give an overview of sorts. Now, there are a number of large perspectives regarding the state of Israel in general. And by extension, these perspectives are going to impact on how we understand the Six-Day War. Meaning to say, and we have to try to keep an open mind about this, meaning to say, there is one perspective, which is the religious Zionist perspective, the perspective that we here in this shul adopt, the perspective that Medinat Yisrael is Reshit Tzmichat Golateinu, meaning it's a step in the process toward bringing Mashiach. Now, that perspective attributes tremendous significance to Hakamat HaMedina in 48, and by extension, to Shechrur Yerushalayim in 67. There is an extremely opposite perspective, and that is the Satmar perspective. The Satmar perspective, and I say Satmar just as a way of broadly defining it, it's not necessarily Satmar, and it's not only Satmar, but it's best expressed by the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, who, by the way, was a Goyin Olam. The Satmar Rebbe was a super-duper amazing genius. And if you're a Satmar, you believe that the establishment of the State of Israel to begin with was a terrible thing. You see, the Gemara in Ksubis says, that God made us take three Shavuos and the nations of the world take one Shavuot. We're swearing that we're not going to rebel against the nations of the world, so we shouldn't fight against them. We are supposed to be quietistic, pacifistic, not fight at all. And if the Jews go and they take Eretz Yisrael by force, that means that the Jews are bad, evil, rishaim. When the Jews who did this were in fact, from the Satmar perspective, absolute total Rishayim, so this is a really bad thing. It's a really bad thing. But if you're a Satmar, 48 is a bad thing, but that's a Halbitzar. Comes along 67, and it's even worse. Because in 67, like we'll see some of the details of the war, right, this is a miracle by simple account, simple read of the situation is this is miraculous. So if you're a Satmar, you're like, oh my gosh, miracle, how could that happen? So the Satmar Rav wrote this kuntras called Al HaGeula V'Al HaTemura. As you notice, I bought this. It says, Isser Gomer L'Hotzi L'Chutz La'aretz. I bought this in Yerushalayim on one occasion. I didn't take this Isser all that seriously. But the Satmar Rav, it also only cost me 10 shekel, I have to admit. I got a good deal on it.
Must have been subsidized.
The Satmar, because you're not supposed to take it to Chutz La'aretz, but the Satmar Rav feels that there's something called Al HaGeula V'Al HaTemura, right? That's a pasuk in Rus, right? Temura means the exchange. Temura is technically a halachic concept. If I have one animal that has Kedusha, and I decide to exchange the Kedusha on animal X and allow that Kedusha to go on to animal Y, those are pasukim in B'chukosai, right? And says the Satmar Rav, quoting from Midrashim, that there's Ge'ula, there's authentic redemption, and then there is Temura, there is exchanging, right? There is this fake, inauthentic, not real thing going on, and that, says the Satmar Rav, is here what happened in 67. So his perspective is that the events of 1967 were caused by Samael, who is one of the chief demons in Yiddishkeit. And Samael, it looks like a miracle to you. But you know what? We have episodes in Chumash. Like, Paro has all these magicians, and they do lots of makos, and it looks like it's really miraculous. But you know what? There's like black magic. It's fake. It's not real. It's Samael. That is the Satmar. Now, I'm asking you to please hold your vomit. Right? Hold it. Our job is going to be to try to understand these different perspectives in light of the facts. Right? That's what we're going to try to do. It happens that the best article on trying to explain the Satmar perspective to modern Orthodox Jews is written by Dr. Norman Lamb, who was a president of Yeshiva University. At this point, it's like there's too many presidents floating around, but he was a president of Yeshiva University. In volume 2 of 70 Faces, page 183 and following, he has an article called The Ideology of Natura Karta. And Dr. Lamb, it came from an article he wrote in Tradition in 1971, just reprinted over here. Dr. Lamb tries to explain their position in as cogent a way as possible. Often it can be difficult to try to explain something that you find repugnant in a cogent way, but that is what he tries to do. And after we go through some of the facts, then we'll return to Al HaGu'ula Val HaTemura, and the response to Al HaGu'ula Val HaTemura, which was written by Rav Menachem Kasher, this book called HaTekufa HaGedola. HaTekufa HaGedola is the great time period. He writes at the beginning that no one is giving an authentic Da'as Torah about what happened in 67, because the only Das Torah opinions out there are coming from like the Satmar camp, and he decides to write this 600-page book to try to get, it's an interesting application of the term Das Torah, to explain what happened from a perspective that it's Yad Hashem rather than being the hand of Samael. Okay. So far so good? So that's what we're going to try to do in broad strokes. Okay, it's called the Six-Day War. Mochemet Sheshet Hayamim, Al-Nachsach, the setback is what the Arabs call it, or they call it the Third Arab-Israeli War. Now, what I call this is actually very significant. No? Who coined the term Six-Day War? Which Israelis? Yeah, so, New York Times. So, Yitzhak Rabin was interviewed shortly after the war, and they asked him, what do you think we should call this battle? And they gave him choices. By the way, you can see this in the book that Julian lent me called 6 Days of War, page 309. You could also see it in Wikipedia, which is always interesting. So they gave Rabin a number of choices about what to call it. Do you want to call the war the War of the Sons of Light? Do you want to call it the Victory of Good? Stuff like that. And Rabin said, interestingly, he wants to call it the Six-Day War because it evokes 6 days of creation. Now, on a certain level, he was putting this into biblical proportions, and it really was. Right? It really was a war of biblical proportions. Now, when we speak about the Six-Day War, the title or the subtitle of Michael Oren's book is like the creation of the modern Middle East. So much of the Middle East that we have today is the result not of 48 but of 67. Right? The issues in terms of Arab refugees. It existed beforehand, but to a very, very small extent. After 67, it's a big issue. the question of Hachzarat Shtachim, which is the biggest question that's discussed. These are results of 67. 67 completely changed the map of the Middle East in the sense of, until 67, Israel is fighting. Until 67 here, how will I quote it? Israel now is dealing more with a diplomatic challenge than the military challenge. That's the way I'll say it. Pre-67, the main challenges to the country were military. Post-67, it's diplomatic. Now, the Palestinian issue was created by 67 to a large extent. A lot of this, by the way, is found, just to quote one other book, Mizrahi, for some reason, published Megillat Sheshet Hayamim. They were bothered, how come you have a Megillah for various Yom Tov and there's no Megillah for Yom Yerushalayim? It's actually very good. The author of this is Dr. Chagi Ben Arzi, who's Bibi Netanyahu's half-brother-in-law, no? I think he's Sarah Netanyahu's brother-in-law from her first marriage.
Is there any kind of mishkeh that goes along with it?
Well, no. But what's interesting about this book, Megillat Sheshet Hayamim, is that he argues that we're making a mistake if we only celebrate Yom Yerushalayim, because the real Nitzachon, the real victories, were beforehand and after. Yom Yerushalayim is just one victory along the way, and perhaps we should establish Yomim Tovim for each day of the war. That's the argument of this Megillah, which it tries to write in Biblical Hebrew, but the mixture between Biblical Hebrew and modern Israeli Hebrew comes off as like some weird shatnez. But, okay, design. It is what it is. So now, Wikipedia's article tells us that what led to the war, and we'll talk about why day one of the war should really be a day that a Yom Tov should be established, at least according to this Megillat Sheshet Hayamim. Between 48 and 67, nothing really normalized. Israel in 56 basically captured the Sinai Peninsula, and then in response to international pressure, they agreed to withdraw from Sinai. Right? The UN forced them, force is a strong word, they applied a ton of pressure that they should withdraw, and the condition is that Sinai is going to be demilitarized, and the Straits of Tehran are going to be open. What happened was, on Yom HaAtzmaut in 67, a few things happened. There is a huge parade in Yerushalayim, right at the border. Remember, Jerusalem at this time is a divided city. Right at the border, the Roosevelt Hotel, what was it or something? Right over there, a huge parade of all the Israeli war machinery goes down. The same day, Nasser decides to expel the UN troops from Sinai and to close the Straits of Tehran and to move his army into Sinai.
Well,
now,
just by
this is all Yom HaAtzmaut of 67. Yom HaAtzmaut, by the way, is around three some odd weeks before Yom Yerushalayim.
By closing the Straits of Tehran, is an act of war.
Absolutely. It's an act of war. It goes against, he's expelling the UN. This is, and by the way, the president of the U.S. said that that is an unprovoked act of war to close the Straits of Tehran. Wonderful. At the same time, the president is saying that Israel is not really being defended by America. Right? So America is saying it's an act of war, but America is not coming to fight to help Israel. Okay, Zolzai. Now, yes. Now, thank you for reminding me. Now, what happened was, after they moved their troops, and we're not talking about an insignificant number of troops who moved into the Sinai Peninsula, the Egyptian army at this point, the entire Israeli army, numbers 264,000 soldiers, including Miluim.
Right.
The majority are people on Miluim. Now, that means you don't really have 264,000 soldiers. Because if you are doing reserve duty, you have to go back a little bit, you have a regular job. It's not a very large army. The Egyptian army itself, again, and numbers over here are hotly debated. You have to read footnotes in Wikipedia to see the various shittos, but the Egyptian army itself might have been around 700,000.
In Sinai?
All over. But the vast majority is there in Sinai, and they are lining up. Now, what happened was that you could read this in the section that begins, preemptive airstrike. Yeah, so it goes like this. Israel's first most critical move was a surprise attack on the Egyptian Air Force. Initially, both Egypt and Israel announced they had been attacked by the other country. On June 5th at 7:45 Israeli time, civil defense sirens sounded all over Israel. They launched Operation Mokade. All but 12, it's nearly 200 operational jets launched a mass attack against Egyptian Air Force. Effectively, Israel takes every one of its aircraft, save 12, and they go to attack Egypt. Now, what's going on at this point is they are flying their planes. Now, Israel had certain advantages. It's a big machlokus as to which planes were better. My son is like an expert on military aircraft, so I asked him what's better. Israel had French aircraft at this point. Their Vorter and Mirage, two different types of aircraft. Are they better than the MiG-21s that the Egyptians had, or not as good? It's unclear. It happens that the Jordanians had British aircraft, which were probably better than, if not only as good as, the Israeli aircraft. But Egypt has an air force of 450 planes, and Israel has a total of 200. Of those 200, 12 stay back, and they go and they attack Egypt. And what they do is they bomb all the runways. And they crater the runways. They have special French-made cratering bombs that go, and they crater the runways. And then, obviously, the aircraft can't take off. And then, there's no anti-aircraft fire against them. So they just keep on going. They have a clear shot. So after they crater the runways, they go and they bomb the planes. And in most cases, no one is flying. None of the Egyptian planes are flying. And effectively, the entire Egyptian Air Force is defeated on the ground. That's the basic story. All right, awesome. Now, so it was, they left at 7. At 7:45, they have the first bombing. Ultimately, by the way, within 6 hours, by like 12:45, 1 o'clock, they left at 7, by 12:45, 1 o'clock, not only had the Egyptian Air Force been knocked out, but the Jordanian Air Force and the Syrian Air Force and a few Iraqi planes. The Iraqi planes had some Pakistanis who were trying to help them also, basically, why? But they are all largely disabled. And for the rest of the war, Israel is able to have air cover for its operations on the ground. That is the fact that everybody knows. Now, how this came about is as follows. And Wikipedia refers to part of it. Wikipedia says here, meanwhile, the Egyptians hindered their own defense by effectively shutting down their entire air defense system. They were worried that rebel Egyptian forces would shoot down the plane carrying Field Marshal Abdel Hakim Amr and Lieutenant General Sidki Mahmoud, who were en route from Al-Maza to Bir Tamada in the Sinai to meet the commander of the troops stationed there. Effectively, you have this Egyptian deputy general of sorts who wants to visit Egyptian troops. And he decides to fly, and he says, don't shoot any anti-aircraft missiles while I'm up in the air, because I'm flying. Not only did he say that, but he said, you know what, you cannot shoot anti-aircraft missiles until you get special permission from me. Now, this held Egyptian anti... Now, you got to imagine, like, what are these Egyptian people thinking? Okay, you have all these Israeli planes coming in, like, the plane's going the wrong way! Like, well, what's going on? They're not shooting! And that's why, because they were under orders not to shoot. That's one thing. Next thing that happened. The night before, the Egyptians decided to have a large party where the vast majority of the Air Force generals were invited to a rowdy party that involved alcohol. Yes, they are Muslims. It involved alcohol and belly dancers. And they're having a great time until 2 o'clock in the morning. And they're huyazaching, right? And they're singing their exciting Yiddish songs or whatever Egyptians do, right? And they're having a great time. And you know what happens when you go to bed at 2 a.m. after you're drunk? You don't wake up in time for your 7:30 flight. Right? Egyptian Air Force is supposed to be flying a 7:30 flight every day of surveillance on the area. But they didn't wake up. Why didn't they wake up? Because they were too busy huyazaching. So not only do they have this general who, what's it called, right? The general who says, hold the anti-aircraft fire, but they also have all the soldiers, right? All the generals are sleeping in. Not only that, but a few days before, Egypt and Jordan had come to a peace agreement wherein Egypt is going to take control of the Jordanian army. Right? So Jordan, which is north of Egypt, right? You have to know a little bit about the map. Jordan is north of Egypt, is now under the control of the Egyptian army. Well, there's a large radar base. And the Jordanian radar base notices the Israeli planes going. And the Jordanian radar base had exchanged codes with the Egyptians, right? To say, if we notice planes on our radar, we'll tell you. Israel was trying to fly very low into Egypt to avoid their radar. But when they took off, they flew higher, they were detected by the Jordanian radar. And the Jordanian radar giving the sign in Arabic, which is to say grapes. Basically. And they keep on saying grapes, 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 time and time again to the Egyptians. And the Egyptians didn't get what's going on. Why did they not get what's going on? Because the Egyptians had changed the sign beforehand. Originally, the sign was grapes, but they changed the sign for some... You always keep your signals. You keep on changing them.
The password.
They changed the password, and because they changed the password, so they're saying grapes, and I'm like, we don't know what grapes means. Just keep on doing whatever we're doing. And you know what happens? Israel comes, and they knock out the Egyptian army on the ground. This is day one of the war. Day one of the war also involves later in the day conquest of the majority of Gaza. That's on day one of the war. Okay? Now, just to go through the other days of the war very quickly, day two of the war is the conquest of Shomron. Day three is the conquest of Yerushalayim. The conquest of Yerushalayim is done mostly by paratroopers. Why paratroopers? Why don't they use tanks? First of all, the terrain isn't good. Why don't they use infantry? Why paratroopers?
Hand-to-hand fighting.
But Israel was scared of using heavy fighting. Heavy arms in the old city because they were worried about destroying the holy places. Moshe Dayan gave strict instructions on day two, don't capture Yerushalayim. Dayan did not want them to capture Yerushalayim. And he told Rabin, don't capture Yerushalayim because I'm worried that we'll capture Yerushalayim and international pressure will make us give it back and it's going to divide the nation. The man is prescient. Right? So he's thinking in the chess match three steps ahead. So he says, oh, don't capture Yerushalayim because then we'll have to return it. Well, day three of the war comes, and there's already talk of a ceasefire. And you have to remember that at this point they have a unity government, first time in Israel. Menachem Begin, who's a known right-winger, Kayadua, Begin is pushing in the Knesset to take it, go. Right? Eretz Molateinu. Right? Let's go. Now, what happens is, right, Dayan succumbs to Begin because Begin is saying, we don't got much time, they're going to impose a ceasefire, we have to take it. So Dayan says, okay, do it. But don't do it with heavy artillery, only paratroopers. And again, the issue with the paratroopers, Mutter Gur and his group of paratroopers, if you read the book Like Dreamers, it's the story of these paratroopers who took the old city, Rav Yoel Ben Nun, what's his name? You know, like...
Yossi
Kwanawe, you wrote the book. This entire group of paratroopers who took the old city, it's a very impressive group. They made some tactical errors on the way into the city. They went down the wrong street one time, etc. So there are really two groups that end up getting into Yerushalayim. One group comes in through Shar HaAshvot, right down at the bottom by the Kotel. The other group comes in through Shar HaAriyot. The group that came in through Shar HaAriyot is the more famous group. They come in, they conquer Yerushalayim basically without a fight. So day three is Yom Shikur Yerushalayim. That is day three. Day four, they capture most of Yehuda and Shomron in terms of Beit Lechem, in terms of Hebron. Hebron is captured single-handedly by Rav Gorin. Now, effectively, the army is supposed to go into Hebron. They got word that they're not going to have much of a fight going, but they're all waiting to go in for a certain time until they get a signal, and Rav Gorin's radio didn't really work, and he goes straight into Hebron himself, and there's all these white flags there to greet him, and he just drives right up, and the Sheikh of Hebron gives him the keys to Maarat HaMachpelah.
Like the Hafsara
from the Torah. I mean, the Nasu, right, they're going to run away from the a driven leaf, right? They're just going to get out of your way. That's what happened. That's why he conquered Hebron. By the way, the stories of conquering Yerushalayim, and like, it's frightening. You listen to their videos on YouTube about the Har HaBayis V'Yadenu, and Rav Gorin then came to blow the shofar. They had a tefillah. They decided for some reason, all the paratroopers are up on Har HaBayis, they decided to go down and daven at the Kotel. And they had a joint... Why don't they daven up on Har HaBayis? They're there already. Why don't they? Apparently they were used to... Jews daven at the Kotel. We don't daven up on Har HaBayis. So they went down and they daven at Har HaBayis. Rav Gorin came to the shofar. They had like a whole beautiful ceremony. The first civilians who came to daven at the Kotel, they brought a group, was Rav Tzvi Yehud and the Nazir. Right? They're the first people who come to daven at the Kotel. Happens on Yom HaAtzmaut a few weeks beforehand, Rav Tzvi Yehuda had given a speech where Rav Tzvi Yehuda had like a certain almost prophetic gaze to him. As he would get into stuff, and he got like extremely passionate, and he said like, how come we don't care about Yerushalayim? How come we're not trying to take Yerushalayim? How come we're not trying to take Hebron and Beit Lechem? And he's like going through it, and he's getting like all worked up on Yom HaAtzmaut in the Sichas of the Yeshiva. And a few weeks later, he comes, and Ratzvi Yehuda is the first civilian to daven at the Kotel. A few weeks right before Yom Yerushalayim, Naomi Shemer composes a song called Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Right? The song Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, when it's originally composed, is different than the song Yerushalayim Shel Zahav that you know. Because she composed Yerushalayim Shel Zahav before the Shechrur Yerushalayim. So the stanza goes, Echayav, Echayav, Shuborot Hamayim, Kikar Hashuk Reka, Be'en Koked Et Har Habayit, Ba'ir Ha'atika, Uvamarot Asher Basala, Miyalelot Ruchot, Ve'en Yored El Yam HaMelach, Biderech Yericho. Right? In other words, but the song originally says that the drying wells and the fountains, the marketplace is forgotten. No longer does anyone come to pray. Rocky caves at night are haunted by sounds of long ago. When are we going to return to the Yam HaMelach by way of Yericho? That's the original words. 3 weeks later, after the Shechrur Yerushalayim, so instead of Echayav Shubarot Hamayim, Chazar Nuvarot Hamayim, Ashuk V'Lakikar, right? That's the tune that we know the tune. Anyway, but that's the words that we know. Effectively, like, the change was amazing. And this played into the system, this euphoria that people have that we finally conquered Yerushalayim, and it's unbelievable. So that is day four of the war in terms of getting Beit Lechem and Hebron. They're still fighting in Sinai. Day four and day five, they actually win Sinai. Day six, they decide not to accept the proposed ceasefire because they want to take the Golan. because the Golan had been the place from where Syria was bombing and shelling everything in the Hula Valley. So they wanted to take... Now, taking the Golan was not easy because you're fighting an uphill battle. Pardon the pun, but it's actually real. You don't fight land wars in Asia. You shouldn't try to fight uphill battles. These are like great lessons in life. And the fact is that they take the Golan, they accept the ceasefire, end of the Six-Day War. That's the basic story. And then from here on, everything is what we mentioned in the introduction in terms of how we now deal with a Middle East after the Six-Day War. Now, a few things that are worth mentioning. Elie Wiesel was interviewed right after the Six-Day War. And Elie Wiesel said, the Forward just published this a few months ago. Actually, today I was talking to Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger and talking to him, giving Shirim about giving trends. So you have to use this Elie Wiesel quote. So Elie Wiesel said that it's very important to tell the story of Shachar Yerushalayim, because if we don't keep on saying it over 50 years from now, people are going to change the facts. Yeah. That's also a prescient comment. In the sense of Holocaust denial is real. And there's a concern that, as well documented as it is, this war was done in a way the whole world saw, pretty much. Now, yes, originally the Arab media was reporting what we would call alternative facts. Right? The Arab media is saying that they are defeating the Israelis. Yeah. And that, by the way, played into Iraq getting involved in the war earlier than they wanted to, Syria getting involved earlier than they wanted to, which led to them trying to prepare their aircraft, and that's why Israel on that day one was able to destroy the aircraft of Iraq and Syria also. I should point out that Israeli aircraft and Israeli fighter pilots were trained differently than fighter pilots of other countries. Israeli fighter pilots are trained to fly 4 sorties a day. Most fighter pilots are trained for 2 a day. There's a big difference. Right? They were flying sortie after sortie. Those first 6 hours really set the tone for the entire war. So that's the long introduction of what happened in a thumbnail sketch. Yeah.
When did we turn the Harabite over to the Waqf?
So we never really didn't turn it over to the Waqf. We had it. There was a discussion in the Knesset, basically the day after the war, what to do. There is some historical debate about what happened. Apparently on the 19th of June, the war ended June 10th, right? June 11th or June 10th, I forget, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, June, right? So the war ended on the 11th, so the 19th of June, Israel... in the Knesset, they made an offer that would return Golan to Syria, return Sinai to Egypt, in exchange for long and permanent peace. The offer was given through the Americans. Rumor has it, according to some, that the Americans never delivered that message. The Arab states had a meeting in Khartoum, in Sudan, shortly after, and they decided to enact all these statements that since Israel took our land illegally, they weren't supposed to take it, therefore we're going to continue a state of war with Israel. Right? That was the reaction, but Israel had attempted to make peace. Part of that Knesset decision on the 19th is that the Har Habayis went back. But we never really controlled the Har Habayis. It went to the Jordanian Waqf, and immediately, in part because Dayan was very worried, probably rightfully so, that if we're going to control it, what will happen? Now, if you are a Satmar, and you want to take some understanding of what happened, you say 1 second. Right? And the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoelish, in his introduction, quotes from an Orach Chaim HaKadosh on the Pasuk that says that you're supposed to destroy all the Avodah Zarah in Eretz Yisrael. Orach Chaim HaKadosh has one, that if you don't destroy the Avodah Zarah in Eretz Yisrael, so it's Kikimu, you yourself are Ovid Avodah Zarah. So he says, you know what, because we had an opportunity to really destroy the Avodah Zarah, we didn't, like, blow up the mosque, as they say, so therefore, we are tantamount to open the Avodah Zarah, and therefore, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, it's all against what Hashem wants. That's his first argument.
Don't we say that Islam is not what it's are, but Christianity is?
Okay. The Satmar Rebbe is obviously not... The thing about the Satmar Rebbe is he's brilliant. And he can lace millions of sources together. Not everything is rigorous. But he's worried. And there is real Avodah Zarah in Yerushalayim that we didn't destroy, no? There's a Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is... apparently there are like fist fights there every single day about who controls which area. There are different Christian groups, and for hundreds of years they've been fighting. You think Jewish politics is bad? Right. Unbelievable.
Right.
The Muslim has the keys. But the Muslim has the keys because they don't want, because none of the Christians trust each other. And they've been fighting about this for many, many years. Now, the Satmar understands on a fundamental level that everything that happened over here has to be the hand of Samael. It's not Yad Hashem. That is given. And the reason why is because they feel fundamentally, where's my source sheet? They feel fundamentally that it can't be that Hashem will do miracles through Rishayim. And there are a number of sources that now we're up to the Torah part, there are a number of sources that say that miracles can't come about through Rishayim. Let's take a look at here, we'll do the Gemara in Avodah Zarah first. The IDF, Israelis in general, non-religious Jews in general, or Rishayim, slice the cat any way you want, they're all wicked, and God won't do miracles. So that's the premise. So if God's not doing miracles, obviously those things that look like miracles are one of two things. And the Satmar analyzes it in one way. Either it is a demonic act, it's the hand of Samael. Alternatively, the Satmar Rebbe says, you think it's a miracle, it's not really a miracle. War isn't miraculous.
That's what Oren says, basically.
Huh?
That's what Oren says, basically.
Correct. I mean, so, the Satmar quote a few different Gemaras. Gemara of Avodah Zarah Yudches. Bria, the wife of Remeya, the daughter of Kanina ben Tradion. So the Gemara earlier in the Avodah Zarah spoke about how her sister, another daughter of Chanina ben Trajon, is taken, and she's with the Zono, she's with the prostitutes. So Shaka Takaba the Dini Va'azal. Omar, Ilo Asabiba Isura Mis Abid Nisa. I of the Isura Lo Asabid Lo Nisa. So what Reb Chanina ben Trajan does is he takes a pouch full of coins and he says, if she did an Aveira, she's with the Zona, she's with the prostitutes, if she actually did what prostitutes do, then no miracles will happen. But if she didn't, the miracles will happen. So he goes and he makes himself look like just a regular wagon driver and he says, let me be with you. She says, no, I'm a needy, I can't do it now. So he says, I'm going to get angry. So she says, oh, there are many women who are prettier than me, why do you need me? So Hanin Rekhan says, you know what? This woman obviously never did any Aveiros, and therefore miracles can happen. If miracles can happen, so he has this whole trick that you say, Eloka de Meir Aneni, that's the Gemara, and somehow you're going to end up being freed. And that's what happened, that's in the Gemara. But says the Satmar Rebbe, you see from this Gemara, that the premise is that miracles only happen to people who don't do Averos. That's his premise. And there's a Chuvas HaRashba that has a similar idea. The Chuvas HaRashba, I'm playing off of the story, it's in Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Daled, by Yifto Amis Yehonasan, right? And they said that Yehonasan couldn't have been mazed. Remember, there's some story that Yehonasan goes along just with his nar, and they attack the Plishtim, right? And in the process, Yonatan takes some of the devash on his stick, and he licks it, and Shaul HaMelech had made some cherem not to do that. So it's clear in the Pesukim that they're saying something like, you can't be that Yonatan was amazed, that Yonatan was amazed, because had he been amazed, had he done it on purpose, so no miracles would have happened, the Teshua wouldn't have happened through Yehonah's son, had he done the sin, the mace, had he eaten that honey intentionally. Now, because, says the Rash, but God doesn't do miracles through Rishayim. Now,
before Rishayim.
For Rishayim. Through and for.
But the Jews in Mitzrayim were on the 49th level of Tumah, and they were all saved.
Good. Right. But the miracles were done through Moshe and Aharon. Right. Right? Miracles are not done through Rishayim, right? So it can't be, says the Satmarov, that what is going on in the Six Day War is miraculous. Now, how can we reject these proofs? How can we reject these proofs? So Rav Kasher, Rav Mendel Kasher, in his Hatkufa Gdola, chapter 2 of the book, he basically argues that there's two different types of miracles. There's some miracles which are miracles beyond Derech HaTeva. Now, if you have just Yehonatan and his Nar, and they are going to attack the entire Plishti force, that's a miracle beyond nature. The miracles that happen with the door of Kanina ben Tradion are miracles beyond normal nature. Say, Eloka de Me'anini, somehow you get out free. Like, what's going on over here? So, if you have a miracle that is outside of the natural realm, those miracles don't happen to Rishayim. But miracles that happen in nature, those miracles can happen to Rishayim. And then, what Rav Kasher argues is that we see this through Tanakh time and time again. I give you one of the sources he quotes, Yeravam ben Yoash, who, by the way, was, as the song goes, he was worse than Henry the First. Yeravam ben Yoash ended up conquering more territory than Yehoshua ben Nun and then David Melech Yisrael. And how did this happen? So the Gemara says he had one good thing. So says Rav Kasher, if you have one good thing, perhaps that's enough to have the type of miracle, even though you're a Rasha, but a type of miracle that's a natural miracle, a miracle that comes about through war, that type of miracle can come about even if you are a Rasha, providing you have one good thing. That's his first argument. What? So natural miracles, I think, means something that's out of the ordinary. Something that's unusual in the context of war. Something that you have a very large force defeated by a very small force. That is a natural miracle. It's a miracle that can be explained. Right? For example, the war and the victory of day one of Mohammed Sheshet Hayamim is a natural miracle. We can explain that Israel was better trained. We can explain that there was Arab incompetence. And it's all true. So that's called a natural miracle. So natural miracles, says Rav Kasher, can happen through Rishayim. He is not taking the approach that these people are not Rishayim, which is another very possible approach to take, that people are considered Tinokel, Chenishbu, etc. He doesn't go that way. He says, yeah, miracles can happen through Rishon, providing they are a natural type of miracle.
The example of that with the Egyptian guys getting drunk.
It's a right. In other words,
it's in the course of nature, but it's a series of happy.
It's a series of coincidence. It's the type of miracle more similar to what we would say is Megillas Esther.
Yeah.
Right? That is, and Rav Kasher then quotes this Gemara Me'ila, that Yavo Hanes Mikol Makom, that miracles can come from anywhere. That is his basic idea. Now the Satmar Rav does not like the idea that these wars are miraculous at all. The Satmar Rav effectively argues that war is never miraculous. And he spends a lot of time analyzing the Yontif of Chanukah. The Yontif of Chanukah, according to the Gemara, is established because we found this little jar of oil. What about the war? So comes along the Satmar Rav and he says, War, that's not a miracle, because in war, all the time, small forces defeat large forces. I, in Al Hanisim, we say, Masarta Gibarim Biyad Falashim, Babim Biyad Ma'atim. It sounds like that's a miracle. So the Satmar Rav says, no, you gotta keep on reading. Rabim Biyad Ma'atim, Tmeim Biyad Tohirim, Zaydim Biyad Uske Sarasecha. Meaning to say, says the Satmar Rav, and he develops this idea based on, the man's a Goinoilom. He develops ideas based on Zohars and other sources that say that if you're a tzaddik and you're fighting forces of evil, those forces of evil are going to be strengthened to take away some of your tzidkus. And it's entirely possible that you are going to do averos at times of war that you never did beforehand, which is why the Torah goes out of its way to say, v'nishmarta mikol davara, the psukim kiseitze, where is it? They speak about how when you go to war, you have to be much more careful about averos than you are at any other time, because the Yetzirah, the Satan, is coming to combat you, and it's going to be impossible almost to win a war as a tzaddik and as Oskei Sarasecha. So the miracle, says the Satmar Rav, is not that it's Rabin Biyad Ma'atim, right? The miracle is that Oskei Sarasecha won, because usually when you win a war, you end up losing your Torah stature. Now, this is what we would call in Yiddish far-fetched. Right? The Satmar Rav is standing, like Rav Kasher says this about them, and Dr. Lamb actually has some nice expressions, but time is late, when he says something to the effect of that his ideology blinded him to what's really going on. A simple read of the situation is that all of these small coincidences come together, and that's what we mean by a miracle. And by the way, it's not just, there are reporters, the New York Times reported right after the Six-Day War about the nearly miraculous of, right, that's a word in the Times.
That's miraculous.
Right, they use the word nearly miraculous. Rav Kasher in chapter 19, he quotes like all of these stories of like miraculous types of things, that a bomb fell over here and the people had just left there and they were saved, all these types. Now again, my wife always uses the expression that the plural of anecdote is not data. Right? So something happens more than once doesn't mean that it proves anything. But he tries to pile on all of these stories, and you know what, if you have enough of these stories, it does lead in the direction of, you know what, Kenzine, it could be that this really was miraculous.
Preponderance of evidence.
Right? It's much more like, what's the most likely understanding of what happened? That's really the question. This, for the Satmar and their approach, and there are some in-between approaches, for the Satmar approach, it is not at all miraculous. It's the eye of the hand of Samael, if it's miraculous, or it's just completely natural. We could argue that, you know what, yeah, it was natural, but that itself is the miracle. Rav Kasher goes the opposite direction. Rav Kasher basically, and this is why these battles became very intense, the Hashkofa battles, Rav Kasher accuses the Satmar Rav of being a Kofar Be'ikar. Right? Now, right, Rav Kasher basically says, you know what, he quotes all these midrashim about Oz Yashir Moshe Sashir Azos of Neisar Leymar, Ma Leymar, Leymar Ledoros, that effectively when a miracle happens, you have a responsibility in all generations to repeat that miracle again and again. And the Midrash says if someone doesn't repeat Nifla Oz Hashem, if someone attributes Nifla Oz Hashem to natural occurrences, that person's a kofar. So Rav Kasher stacks the deck in the opposite direction. Now, if you want Klal Yisrael not to have these divisions, you're probably better off taking some middle road and saying, it's a miracle, yes. Like, in other words, Satmar Rav recently tried to say it's all natural, yeah, but that doesn't mean it's not a miracle. I think that's a better middle ground. What Rav Kasher is saying, building the miracle up, and therefore saying, as a result, that they are kofrim for denying the Yad Hashem. Like Eliyahu HaNavi at Har HaKarmel says, Aneini Hashem, Aneini, and one of the expressions in Chazal, the double Lashon Aneini, Yishalo Yomer Masek Shafim Hu. No? That people shouldn't say that this is just some sort of black magic, but what Rav Kasher is doing is he's going in the opposite direction. Okay, that's really what we're up to. This is most of what I wanted to say. Let me take one or two questions. And hi.
So what would Rabbi Kasha say to the Ramban idea of what a miracle is? Is Ramban?
Oh.
Ramban,
yeah, so that's actually something that I was thinking to about, but I didn't. I like to say over, and when we did the Navi Shir many times, I repeated C.S. Lewis and in his world, in the Christian world, miracles are very important. The Rambam contends that miracles are not at all important. Moshe Rabbeinu lo haminu bo yisrael et neho osos v'amofsim, says the Rambam, Hilchos Yisrael de'at Torah. Rather, we believe because we ourselves saw. Right, that we were all there at Har Sinai and we heard, right, Moshe, Moshe, lechem olahem kach v'kach. Right, that's the Lashon HaRambam. So now, Judaism traditionally does not place any weight on miracles. The Satmar Rav, towards the end of this book, goes in that direction. He says, even if it's miracles, Judaism doesn't care about miracles, forget about that. Now, Rav Kasher's argument is, you know what? Atem re'isem. You yourself saw it. So maybe, right? In other words, just like the Rambam is saying over there, that we don't believe because of miracles, but we believe because we ourselves saw, this is Atem Re'isim. And he stacks the deck in terms of, he quotes all of these Haredi thinkers. Reb Chatzkel Levenstein, who was the famous Mashkiach. Reb Chatzkel gave a Musar Shem after the Six-Day War on the pasuk Atem Re'isim. You yourself saw the miracles, so you can't deny it. It's more like that Rambam. That's sort of my answer to you.
Well,
yeah.
No, what I was really asking is the Rambam says that miracles are yad hashem, and the Rambam says no, they're natural occurrences.
You're speaking in two broad terms. No one denies miracles. Let's talk about a different time. I don't think that would be a question on any approach that we're saying, but we'll discuss it separately. Yeah. Let me just hear from Frida.
Just kind of a sidelight. There aren't any miracles at all, but isn't there a bracha you can say if you're in a place where a miracle happened to you?
Absolutely.
There's miracles that are, different. But just a question, this business about the three O's. First of all, where is that?
So I'm thinking of maybe doing this as my Shavuos talk this year. I was thinking maybe doing Shalosh Shavuos, unless someone else is doing it. Is it? So I was thinking of like maybe broadening these types of ideas into general Zionism. So maybe we'll talk about that on Shavuos. The Gemara in Ksuba speaks about how the Pesukim and Shir Hashirim have the Shalosh Shavuos that Klal Yisrael had to swear. One of them is that we're not going to be Shalosh Yalo B'choma. The question is as to whether the Shalosh Shavuos is still binding, when they ever were binding halachically. There's a lot to say. That is like the background of the Satmar Shita. It's in Shir Hashirim Beis Zayin is once, and then it's Shir Hashirim in Perek Ches Pasuk Hey, and then it's Shir Hashirim in Perek Gimel. There are four times Hishpat Yisachem. Three of them are Hishpat Yisachem, and then the other one is Hishpat Yisachem and Nos Yerushalayim. Right, the different trap on number four.
The thing is, to give the Satmar Rebbe his due, which I obviously not follow, the Satmar Rebbe, if he takes that seriously, then he's got a case.
Yes.
You can't say he's just totally off his rocker.
Correct. There is a Gemara about the Shalosh Shavuos. If you take it seriously, the basic point I'm trying to make is that the Satmar Rebbe is a huge Talmud Chacham, and the points he's making have to be thought about seriously. But at the same time, we have to think about it using our rational faculties. And you look at the evidence. The evidence, I think, leads in the direction that this is a miracle. Now, if something is a miracle, do we have a responsibility to establish a yontiv because of it or not? So, there's an Ibn Ezra in the pasuk of Ubiyom Simchaskam Moadechem of Rosh Chodchechem Tekatim Chatzotzos, right? Vinoshatem Oivechem, right? The first one says, and then the next pasuk is so the Ibn Ezra says that when you win wars, you have an obligation to establish Yamim Tovim, and that Ibn Ezra is the source of establishing Yamim Tovim like Yom Yerushalayim, etc. The Nitziv asks a question to Ibn Ezra in his Perushan Chumash. Nitziv says, one second, but throughout Tanakh, no one ever established Yamim Tovim when they won wars. we had wars all the time, and they didn't establish Yemen Tovim. They only established Yemen Tovim when they built a Beis HaMikdash, when they re-established the Mizbeah. But they don't establish a Yontif from the victory of every war. And there's a few directions that you could go in this. Rav Kasha takes the approach that he's convinced that this war that we had in 67 is Mohammed Gog Magog, and there are many sources that you can establish a Yontif for Mohammed Gog Magog. That is a hard approach. Rav Shechter in his Sefer Be'ikvei Hatzon takes the approach that on a certain level the reconquest of Yerushalayim is a stage in the establishment of the Mizbeach, and as such you can be koveya a yontiv just like they were koveya yamim tovim on the rededication of the Mizbeach, etc. That's Rav Shechter's approach that also requires much more than two sentences. Okay, so thank you very much. And next week it happens, I can't be here. They're making a dinner, the Rosh Hashim making a dinner for President.